Well, good evening. You know, I'm blessed to see all you out here this evening. I mean, don't you know Christmas is coming? You guys have the right priorities, and God bless you for it. Let's get out our Bibles and open up to Daniel, the book of Daniel. We're in chapter 3 this evening. A very familiar passage. I have the VeggieTales video. And if you don't have the VeggieTales video, I'm not trying to sell it, but it is definitely one of the best VeggieTales videos. I think personally they should have released that one over the Jonah video that they released in the big theaters, because Shaq, Rack, and Benny. Man, it is a great video, and it's funny, and but you know what? The story's great. They did a great job. But anyhow, that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. So Daniel chapter 1, I don't have to tell you that this is about men going through the fire, believers going through the fire. Peter, of course, telling us, because he had been through the fire. He says, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing has happened to you. But rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy." Trials in life are inevitable. God, in those trials, they're not happening aimlessly and haphazardly. Difficulty doesn't come our way as believers necessarily because we are not walking with God rightly. Now, we don't go through the fire for those reasons only, you see. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7 says that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than that of gold that perishes, though it be tried with the fire, might be found unto praise and to honor and glory at the appearing of Christ Jesus. God is working a work in those days of difficulty that come our way, certainly. And that's what we see before us in our story here. You remember last time together, old Nebi had gotten his dream interpreted. That's an interesting word. Look that up in the dictionary and let me know what it means and get back with me. No, he got it interpreted. Last time together, God gave Daniel the revelation, and Daniel laid it out and said, "Hey, Nebuchadnezzar, this dream, this is the history of man's rule on planet Earth, the times of the Gentiles. And Nebi, you're the guy that's starting it all, and you're the head of gold, and your perfect rule, and then Medo-Persian Empire, and then down, 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 until it comes to the last days thing." And we looked at that a little more extensively last time together, and we're going to look at it again. So I haven't exhausted that issue. So if you're going, "Well, he didn't explain that very fully or as much as I'd like to last time," that's because we're going to see it again. And so we'll get it between the two times. But you see, after he interpreted that dream, it's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar, now, between chapter 2 and the end there, when Daniel was lifted up to his lofty and high position there as a governmental authority above the Chaldeans, by the way, whose life, because of him, their lives were spared, the magicians and the soothsayers and the Chaldeans. Remember, the king was going to kill him because they couldn't interpret his dream. When Daniel interpreted his dream, you remember that they were spared because Daniel asked their lives to be spared. Now, in that time, Nebuchadnezzar had gone to war with Egypt, which is a very idolatrous, as was Babylon, society. Seeing the magnificent statues of the kings and the pharaohs and all that was there, we come to chapter 3, and it's some 20 years later. Daniel is believed to have been on a governmental trip. That's why he's not here in the story, because I believe if he had been in that locality at that time, you know what? He'd be here in the story. But he's not. So that means that he was away on business, it appears. Can't be dogmatic about that because the Bible's quiet on it. So here we have these three Hebrew men, and Nebuchadnezzar decides, after being there in Egypt and seeing the statues of the pharaohs and all, remembering the dream that, well, that Daniel interpreted, he's thinking like some ruler would think in his state of mind. We've got to unite the kingdom. So what I need to do is get something going here. I kind of like the statues and all in Egypt. So you know what? I think I'm going to make something here that the people can kind of latch on to. Kind of a rallying point. Kind of a place to pledge allegiance, if you would. Kind of a place to worship, if you would. I'm going to have like this huge get-together. And I am going to be the star of the show. And so, as a result of that thought process, we pick it up here in verse 1 of chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now I find something interesting right off the bat here. Do you notice two numbers of measurement that are here? 6 and 6. There's 60 and 6. He's setting up an image of himself to be worshipped. We're only missing 1 6 here. You see, 6 speaks of men. The number of man created on the sixth day. You see, and of course Nebuchadnezzar being a ruler of men over the kingdom, we see these two numbers put together. And Nebuchadnezzar, in opposition really to his dream that Daniel interpreted, started off with a head of gold, which was him. Then the Medo-Persians took over, and of course silver, and then the legs of iron, brass, and on down. Nebuchadnezzar, when he's designing this image, approximately 90 feet tall, 6 foot wide, pretty odd looking image. Pretty odd looking image for a man, but you know, they made kind of odd looking images if you look around. This image was going to be all gold. Almost like, hey, you know what? My kingdom's not going to end. I'm making this whole thing in gold. Chest, arms, silver, belly, thighs, the whole thing. What is Nebuchadnezzar doing? I think he's just saying, hey, I'm the best. Nobody's as good as me, and nobody's going to replace me. Little egomania. Men tend towards that, don't they? This image, of course, calculated to impress, with its 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, it certainly would do that. I just got back from Las Vegas this afternoon. You guys are struggling with that right now, huh? So that's where the offering goes, you know. No, my wife actually, there's churches in Las Vegas, and there are godly people in Las Vegas, and my wife just shared at a women's Christmas tea, some 800 women there at Calvary Chapel Spring Valley. And I heard she did a fabulous job. They didn't let me attend. And I wasn't going to cross-dress to try and sneak in. It's you know, it's okay as a guy. I can't imagine what I'd look like as a girl. Just these kind of, they go, that's an ugly, ugly girl. But anyhow, you guys are like thinking that right now, aren't you? You're going, he's right about that. But at any rate, it's interesting because I was cruising down as we're driving out of there at the MGM. It's interesting, I'm teaching on the text, and there they are, you know, there's this big old golden kind lion at the MGM. You've seen it on the TV and the movies, it's rah, you know, you remember that thing. Well, they've got this big statue of it, and there are two cranes on either side, lifts actually, on either side, and a guy in each basket, and guess what they're doing? They're polishing the image. They're polishing this little statue, well, a huge statue, actually. I'm thinking, how interesting, because I'm teaching on that tonight. Here they are. You know what? They're still the statues, man, the stuff. It's to impress. That's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar was doing. Man, to draw attention, to get people together and to look at the magnificence and the design of this thing. Not correct proportionally necessarily, but something to just kind of rally around, you see, if you would, like you had seen in Egypt. Now, there are some scholars who have trouble with this because they say, well, you know, 90 feet wide and you know, 90 feet high and 60 feet wide, that's going to be a, you know, there's no way that is going, or 9 feet wide, rather, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. There's no way there's enough gold for that. You know, solid gold that big. Well, first of all, you know what? That's not necessarily true. I mean, Egypt had lots of gold. They took gold from the temple when they captured Jerusalem. And listen, Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful man on planet Earth at that time. And so he had whatever he wanted. That said, guess what? Just because this says this image of gold is there doesn't mean that it was solid gold. It doesn't say solid gold. It might have been wood with gold overlay. That was a practice that they did at that time as well. Just, you know, overlaid it with gold, man. Just not the kind of stuff like they do today with the little kind of paper gold. This stuff, you know, they had enough to lay it on pretty thick. And the molding it and forming it, if you've ever done, you know, gold molds and forms pretty well in its purity. It does it pretty easily. So those that challenge there's some that actually challenge the accuracy of this book based on that, which is insanity. But you know, if you're looking, I guess, for an excuse, that's as good as any, I suppose. Daniel says that this image was set up on the plain of Dura. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had something in mind here. You see, he didn't want to set it up in the city where there are other buildings and his hanging gardens and all. He wanted to take this outside the city to kind of a rural area, if you would. Maybe, you know, just east of Lucerne Valley, where there's nothing else really around much that would distract in any capacity. And you could gather the people of the world at that time, you see, into the area to do what he wanted to do at this kind of party, if you would. There is, in the plains of Dura, those that study these things, about 6 miles southeast of the city of Babylon, a large mound of bricks still there that many theorize would have been a perfect platform, and many believe for that reason that the image was on that platform at one time. Because there's nothing else really in the area. It's almost as though this mound is just constructed to put something on to gather the people around, but not really to stay there. And from a distance, out there all by itself, saw, you know, with gold, I mean the whole thing gold, I'll bet you that was, you caught your attention. I drove through Baker. There's the world's biggest thermometer. And you know what? from a distance, you're looking, you're going, what is that thing, man? It does attract your attention right away. I mean, there's really nothing that's that high in any capacity around there. And so you're looking at that thing going, what is that thing initially? And then you get close and you find out what it is. You know, I mean, and so this thing, though, glistening in the sun, being made out of gold, far more attractive and far more eye-catching. Like a massive amber mirror, if you would. And so King Nebuchadnezzar sent word, once he got this constructed and put up, he sent word, to gather together the satraps and the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And so the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, the ruler here, Nebuchadnezzar, gathered all the officials, those who are in any kind of political sphere or have any place of power, high and low, wherever they were in the political positions, in the religious positions, he gathered them all together into one place to have a massive political kind of worship, religious meeting. All the officials that were there in any level of government, the lawyers and members of the royal family and the religious practitioners, even the military commanders were all there. When you see that list of people, you realize, you know what, this wasn't any kind of crude form of governing that he had. He had every person in his place. He had a massive organization. It wasn't chaotic or uncivilized in any capacity. Elaborate government control of the people and the economy, the justice system and the military. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to make every branch of his government was loyal to him. Any of the leadership. And so he gathers them all. And then he poses a test calculated to weed out any disloyal, any who might rebel in any way. I mean, after swallowing up the cultures and the communities of Egypt and Jerusalem, it's probably a good thing to kind of get everybody on your side and find out who isn't when you're the king like this guy was. So he flexes his political muscles, if you will, his authoritative muscles. The people gather together. The herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that the king Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace." So there it is. Everybody gathered around. I have no idea how this guy, you know, maybe one guy passed it on and there were people that one guy spoke and then the next series of guys spoke and then the next series of guys spoke. Anyhow, word got around probably from these political officials and people that were around. There were spokesmen that the word was given as they all gathered together. Many of them perhaps able to hear. There wasn't a lot of noise. There wasn't cars. There weren't any jets flying over or cars going by. Guy may have had a kind of a big voice. You know, if I cranked it up, I could get some volume out of this thing. Or maybe they had several reading in harmony. You know, however it was, the message was announced. The test was handed out, if you would. And note here, it had music. It had all, everything that, you know, a good kind of celebration and party is made of. When the music played, and it was no small band, there's several musicians and positions of instruments that are types of instruments that are named there, probably again stationed in various areas, that when one played, then the rest all joined in. I'm sure that it was well rehearsed. And King Nebuchadnezzar is asking all to bow down to this image, to fall down in worship. You either fall and you worship my image, or you fry. The choice is yours. And in so doing, Nebuchadnezzar is claiming to be the embodiment of all the deities, any gods that they had served or been about previously, now were commanded essentially to be set aside, and you worship my image. One religion we need. We need to all be in unity and harmony. Perhaps he read the story of Nimrod in the Tower of Babylon. And he wanted to kind of get in on the action, you see. And so, Nebuchadnezzar, interestingly, when you look at this man, things have changed pretty radically from chapter 2, haven't they? Because in chapter 2, in verse 47, the king answered Daniel after he interpreted, or interpreted, as you would, his dream. He said, truly to Daniel, this is Nebuchadnezzar speaking, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. It's interesting how men are, isn't it? Well, Daniel, you know what? Your God is God. And the God of Israel is superior to any other gods, including, essentially, he's saying there in verse 47 of chapter 2, including the Babylonian gods who have proven themselves through the psychic channelers and magicians and Chaldeans that we have. Your God is proven to be superior to all the gods of Babylon. They have failed and fail miserably. But he's had a change of heart over this 19 to 20 years. He reverted to his old trust in the deities of his homeland, it appears, and of course, himself being the key figure, you see. Maybe part of that was his realization, well, I defeated Jerusalem, the God of Israel. I took that nation captive. I've had victory over the gods of Egypt. And so he has moved kind of away from that belief that he had laid out previously. Reinforcing, of course, his own power and his authority. So it says here, at the time in verse 7, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Now this was a full state event on the scale of the halftime show, maybe the Super Bowl. No one missed this really, except we know Danny wasn't around. But this was a state function here, and like the opening ceremonies, perhaps of the Olympic Games, not everyone tuned in on their TV, but everyone gathered, you see, at this particular event. And the full orchestra as it sounded. And I'm certain it was a huge, big scale production with a lot of time, as I've already stated, to rehearse. And when the moment came and the music sounded, the worship began and people fell down on their face in front of this image. What an awesome sight that probably was for egomaniac Nebi, as he's sitting there on his throne and watching all these people as the music sounds and the drums crash and thunder and the harmonies of the music powerful coming together and people bowing and him sitting there going, whoa, I've arrived. I mean, can you imagine what a production this is? Bowing one after one and just all falling, person after person falling down before him. But, well, as we will see, the majority bowed. But then verse 8, therefore, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Interesting to me. Because here's the guys that Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, don't kill them. It's funny how quickly they forget years later, huh? Years go by, they forget. They kind of get filled with their own kind of self-confidence and arrogance. And you know what? It probably did bother these guys that even though Daniel and the boys did spare their lives and make sure they didn't get murdered as a result of not being able to interpret the king's dream, I'll bet you it kind of galled them that these Jewish boys, young teenagers, and these were seasoned astrologers and soothsayers and psychic channelers, that these young teenagers, young whippersnappers would move into the position of authority over them. Probably initially just glad their lives were spared and very thankful, but ultimately it kind of galled them and it appears bugged them a bit that these guys were in these positions of power and authority. Who are they? Who do they think they are? So they came forward. I can hear them like anyone can hear if you've ever had a tattletale in school or brother or sister. Can you hear them? Mommy! And they're looking right at you. Guess what Dennis did? There was no lack of accusations when Dennis was around that he did something. But did they have to know everything? You had the guy at school. Teacher, guess what Dennis did? Shut up. You know, just knock it off. You don't have to tell him, man. Don't tell. I'm telling. He didn't do it. Yeah, I mean, and if it was he didn't do it, it was usually bad. I mean, it was usually good, and if he did it, it was usually bad. Well, that's what these guys were. They were kind of tattling now, and they came forward to Nebuchadnezzar, and they spoke to him, it says there in verse 9, O king, live forever. There it is, the flattering words. O king, we love you, you know we love you, and we pray that you'll always stay the one that rules because you're such a wonderful person. Of course, he would threaten to kill them earlier, but now they have something here. He says, you, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, king, these guys have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. You see, these guys, do you kind of get the idea that they were a little jealous? And here they are, and they come and say, these foreign guys, these Jewish guys, you know, they're not part of your inner circle. We were always suspicious about their counsel. Well, guess what? It's come to pass, King. I can just picture the scene when the music started. Everybody else fell on their faces in proper worship, including these Chaldeans and astrologers and soothsayers. And as they were falling down, they were thinking that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego weren't going to bow. So they're kind of keeping their eyes. Oh, man, did you see that? Look at those guys. They're not bowing. You can see them nudging one another going, ha ha, you know, we got them. And so they ran to him and give three damaging charges. What were they? Well, one thing, these men have not regarded you, King. And King, they do not serve your gods. And they will not worship your gold image, the one that you have set up and commanded to be worshipped. So they have defied you. They've disregarded your gods, and they are encouraging by their standing and not bowing behavior. They're treasonous, they're blasphemous rebels. Certainly serious charges. Serious charges. Now, does Nebuchadnezzar see through that? Perhaps. Because look at what he does here. He knows these Chaldeans. You know, he had a problem with them previously, right? He was going to murder them. He suspected them, I think, initially. And now he suspects them perhaps again. Maybe not, but I kind of get the idea that he does. And so he responds to their accusations. And Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so they brought these men before the king. Now, I don't know if he was mad because they didn't bow. It doesn't appear that way to me initially. I think he was more ticked off at the political jabbing here and climbing the ladder of these Chaldeans and all coming in and tattling and that kind of a thing. Maybe not. Maybe he was mad that they didn't bow initially. He will get mad that they didn't bow eventually. Although it may not have been the reason here, and I'll tell you why as we go on. Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them saying, is this true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you will be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? You see, I don't think he was mad at them alone initially. And why don't I kind of feel that way? Because he gives them another chance. I don't know if he even believes the Chaldeans and such initially. It appears that perhaps he doesn't. Doesn't it to you? And so he goes, guys, is this true? Okay, I know these Chaldeans and astrologers and all. I'm going to give you another chance, guys. Shows that he didn't really want to kill these guys initially. So I think the anger in this first situation is channeled towards the Chaldeans, and kind of like when the kids come and tattle and you're in the middle of something that you're doing that you're enjoying, and that's certainly where he was at that point. And then they come in and, Mom, these guys are doing it. And don't want to deal with this. You guys, can't you get along, you know, type thing. And so that's what I think is kind of the mindset here. And so he gives them another chance. Now, again, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been faithful in their service towards Nebuchadnezzar as administrators. And so he knew, though interestingly, that these men worshipped a god other than the deities of Babylon previously. I mean, that wasn't news to him. We saw it after Daniel interpreted the dream. But it's interesting to me. Here's a god that interpreted the dream that nobody else could interpret. And Daniel made that very clear to Nebuchadnezzar. And now Nebuchadnezzar kind of challenges that god. Okay, I'm going to give you guys another chance to bow when the music plays. If you don't bow, then you know what? You're going into the fire. And what god can deliver you from that? What was this? Well, I don't know if you caught it, but it's a showdown between the gods of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar and the God of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar, obviously, in his arrogance, had every belief and confidence that his God would win. After all, how could one escape the fiery furnace? But you know what? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered in verse 16 and said to the king, "Well, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." I have to love that, man. These guys, like, weren't making a decision on the scene right at that moment what to do, were they? And we don't see these guys arguing in any way with Nebuchadnezzar or defending themselves. Well, the reason, King, you see, we wanted to bow. We thought we might bow, but you know, we were thinking about it, and it's not. There's no like argument. There's no like defending themselves in any way. They go, "Listen, Nebi, we're not going to argue with you on this, really. I know what you want. You know, I know that you want us to bow, but we can't really. And there's a reason for that. It's not really something that our lives don't belong to us. You see, we belong to the God who we serve. And so, you know, you've told us to bow down, but we can't really bow down because the Ten Commandments says, 'Thou shalt have no other God before us.' We're not to worship or bow down to any idols or other gods. And since we belong to him, like, we can't do what you're asking us to do." It wasn't a showdown. They had nothing to prove. We're not going to plead our case. We're not going to try to talk our way out of this. We're not up for negotiation. And we don't need a second chance, really. Thanks for the offer. But no, it's a waste of your time. We're not going to bow to an idol, and that's it. And listen, I love what they say here. Whether God delivers us from your hands, you know, he is deliverer through the fire or from the fire, guess what? You're not in control. You're not the ultimate authority. They said it very respectfully and very kindly and very tactfully. And I appreciate that. They had no doubt whatsoever in God's ability as we listen to them here to deliver. Now here's what they don't know. And I find this interesting, and I think this is an important point for us tonight. And I'll probably get this point out, and then that'll be done, because we're almost at the end, and we got a few verses left to cover. But here's the key with these guys. They knew God was able to deliver them from the fire in the king's hand, but they didn't know if he was going to deliver them in the way that some might expect, you see. They didn't know if they were going to go into a cremation mode and be immediately, you know, die and that's it, be with the Lord, or if somehow God was going to deliver them from the king's hand. Their God is able, they said, to deliver, and he will deliver us from your hand one way or another, either through death or through the fire. You see, God allows us sometimes to be taken right to the edge. These guys are being tested. Are they going to compromise? Or are they going to follow the Lord? Well, we could bow kind of outwardly, but we're not bowing technically in our hearts. Our hearts are still... So you know what? Hey, we could do that and maybe kind of make life a little easier and not go through so much difficulty. You see, a lot of times we're taken to the edge. Maybe it's a situation where, you know, you're struggling with your health personally. Things are going on with your health, man. You're right there. The doctor says, hey, guess what? The x-rays, they don't look good. God, help me. God, you got to deliver me from this. Lord, you got to heal me. I got so much life. I got so much to do ahead of me. Perhaps it's not you. Perhaps it's one of your children. God, how can you allow this to happen? Here I come, you know, and you brought me all the way into this, and now, Lord, this is such a mess. And you're brought up to this situation. One that you would have never chosen. And you know what? When you come to that situation, when you come to that crisis where the news is bad for your husband, the job situation falls apart, your business is just kind of dwindling away, and you're brought right to the edge there. What are you going to do? I've seen it. I've seen people get mad at God. God, how could you take my wife? How could you let this happen? Where are you? Surely you're going to do a miracle. You're not going to let her go, Lord. You're not going to allow something like that to happen. You don't know. You see, it's when the health crisis comes. It's when these areas where we're thinking or have thought previously, And we pray, and I pray just like you, God, don't let anything happen to my family. Please, Lord. Nobody in my family. God, protect them. Be with them. And Lord, don't let anything happen to my wife. If something happened to my wife, I don't know what I'd do, Lord. I don't know how I'd go on, Lord. My children did something stupid and goofed up their life. Lord, I don't know how I would make it, Lord. Protect them, Lord. Be with them, Lord. Certainly there's nothing wrong with that prayer. But you know what? Things don't always go the way you want them to go. You say, oh, Lord, I'm just giving it all over to you. But are you really? How is it when you're brought to the edge like these guys? The furnace is heated up. And the choice has to be made. Are you going to follow God? Listen, know this. Here's the deal here. Look at what is happening. An audience of huge proportion is all tuned in and watching what these God-fearing men are going to do. Nebuchadnezzar's looking on. The Chaldeans are looking on. Everybody's watching. All the news reporters in our day would be gathered around. What's he going to do? Is he going to compromise? Does he belong to God or not? That's always the question. That's always the question. Is it going to be what God wants you to do? Are you going to do your own thing. God allows these things to happen to us sometimes for that very reason. These guys are about to be strengthened in their faith. And guess what? Guess what? With all those children watching and all those young people and tuned in, you know what? These guys were about to leave a legacy. They were about to pass on a baton. Compromise, carnality, or hey, courage, a life of purity. What was going to be passed down? What was their God like? How sold out were they for their God? What kind of leaders would they be? We're lacking leaders today, aren't we? Why is that? I think to a great degree because we have compromised. Compromised. Not really stood. Lived lives that are holy. Lived lives that are godly. Been the examples, passed on the baton of men and women of integrity, men and women who have sacrificed. Men and women who when the kids are watching, they see your heart and your attitude and your service for God. The young people are seeing marriages that have been together 50 years, godly men and women who love God with all their hearts and who love one another. Who have maybe been through some difficult times and they've seen God bring them together. They've seen them work through those times and stay together and love one another and sacrifice one for another. See men and women and families of integrity who love God. Who live their lives for Him. And the baton is passed on. You see, we're passing on the baton. What's it look like? How is it when you're in these places of decision? When you come to the edge here? You can compromise, and yes, God will forgive. God will forgive. And He has. And I thank God for that. But what does the legacy look like? What's it leave in its wake if you make the wrong choice here and sell out? Will you come to this place and these kinds of tough times in your life and still rejoice in the Lord and still serve Him when you get the bad news? When the business isn't going well? Will you still serve God? Are you sold out and committed to Him above all else? What if this is cremation, guys? What if it's cremation? It's been said the early bird gets the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese. I wonder if when these guys were being led off, if one of them out of the three as they were being led off started going, you know, maybe I'll hang back here a little bit and see if like God does deliver these two. And if He doesn't, maybe I'll bow. But they wouldn't, would they? They were respectful. They were humble, not defiant and aggressive, quietly, simply stating before the king confidently that they were unable because of their God and His law to comply with His command. Because it would violate a higher law. We see that same kind of humble disobedience in Acts chapter 5. Where the disciples were brought before the Sanhedrin and told to stop preaching in the name of Jesus. And Peter humbly responded that they had to obey God rather than man. They were beaten and released with another warning of worse things to come if they didn't stop. And they returned to the very site that they had first been arrested and continued to preach the gospel. We live in a fallen world, and there will be times where the rules of man may conflict with the will of God. When that happens, we have to yield to the higher law, and that is God's law, while maintaining a meek and quiet spirit in dealing with the heat that will catch from man as a result. When Nebuchadnezzar heard from these men, it says that he was full of fury, and the expression in verse 19 on his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Again, which gives me insight is the fact initially he wasn't angry with them. But now we can go there. Because now it's very obvious and clear. Oh, so you guys dare defy me? So these guys weren't lying about you. So you did. So now he's mad. And man, in fury, you do some crazy things. And so we see here, he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. He goes into a rage. Rage usually turns reasonable people into highly unreasonable people. Fury certainly leads to folly, and such is the case here in our story. And you know what? He's not even thinking clearly, because if he wanted to torment Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, wouldn't he command that the fire be cooled and for them to be locked in? Kind of a slow burn. Wouldn't that be more torturous? But he was mad. So he heats it up more than it had been previously. 7 times hotter. Stoke that furnace as hot as it can be. And guess what? We'll see. Next time together. Most of you know the story. But we need some insight. There are some important lessons for us in this story that we'll look at next time together as, well, I'll give you a preview. They get thrown into the fire. Do they make it out or not? Tune in next week. Let's pray.